Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Hi, I'm Helen.
And I'm Stephen.
And this is the New Statesman non-emergency podcast. This is your regularly scheduled podcast. But we are going to do something. We are going to go outside, taking our cue from Andy Burnham. We're going to go outside the Westminster bubble. Mm-hmm. Both you and I have left the M25 in recent times and have come back with much knowledge. But let's talk about Labour's mayoral elections. So I'm inevitably going to forget one, but remind me when I go there. So Liverpool Metro Mayor, the Labour candidate has been announced, that is Steve Rotherham.
Yep.
Manchester has been announced Metro Mayor, that is Andy Burnham, mm-hmm. who people will know and love, no doubt. In Bristol, we have Marvin Rees, who is a Labour Mayor. In London, we have Sadiq Khan, who is a Labour Mayor. And the one I've forgotten is Sean Simon, of the West Midlands, representing my West Midlands crew.
Yeah, he is
The candidate,
yeah.
He's presumably the only one where being the Labour candidate is not the shoo-in that you might hope.
It is very plausible that with the right candidate. I think the interesting thing is, and we got a lot of really interesting emails, and I enjoyed reading this week. But one, and I'm going to portmanteau two names together. One from Marcus.
Badger. How can you forget the one who is who wrote in to us, Dr. Badger?
And I broadly agreed. In fact, I actually think I might be confusing his email with Jack Layton's, but I broadly agreed with both of them. I enjoyed both emails, and one of them made a point that I broadly agreed with, which I'm now about to quote after a long preamble about which one of them actually said it. Please do write in more, so you too can
be misquoted.
My flagrantly bad quoting practices. Then the Tories have a deeper bench and a more impressive field overall than the Labour Party at present, which I think is true. However,
ooh, interesting, because I disagreed with that when I looked at those leadership candidates. I was like, Liam Fox, Boris Johnson, Michael Gove, Andrew Leadsom.
I mean, Boris Johnson, say what you like about him, is very popular.
Yeah,
as a Tory who's won in London. So he obviously has got game.
But Michael Gove is kind of the anti-Jeremy Corbyn, which is that everybody in Westminster loves him and seems mysteriously to think he would be catnip to the electorate, and all actual people in the electorate violently react against him.
Yeah, I think my favourite Venn diagram in politics is right-wing commentators who are like, how are these people voting for Corbyn so out of touch? Michael Gove is popular. They are literally, in polls, they are... Exact. Their polls are a carbon copy of each other. They are liked by about 15% of the electorate, and they are widely identified. They are two politicians who most people have heard of.
Yeah, they know who they are. They just have strong opinions on them one way or the other.
Yeah, and they're mostly not positive. But Michael Gove,
Michael Gove. Sorry, I'm doing my Hamilton thing again.
I mean, Michael Gove unquestionably was a significant operator, right? But I also think, actually, the leadership field is a bit of a misnomer. For me, it comes down to kind of your junior minister level. kind of.
I think that's really true, because when they did the reshuffle, they announced names. For example, when I was, because I've been writing or working on a piece about prisons, when I heard that Sam Giemer had gone to prisons, for example, I thought, oh, well, that's really, you know, he'll be someone who'll be really interesting. He'll be quite good at communicating. And actually, it was at that second tier level where you just thought, oh, that person's quite good. Or like, you know, Harriet Baldwin, for example, you know, sort of those kind of people that probably only people in Westminster have heard of. But there was depth there.
Yeah, I think, and that is the thing you'd really notice if like me, you're, you know, a big nerd who, like, you know, the things I really noticed about the kind of policy issues I'm really into, so I will watch all of the Commons debate, is that the Secretary of State level, you'll look at the Labour person and be like, oh yeah, they're about equivalent. I mean, obviously less so now with this slightly...
Well, people having to kind of do three jobs, triple it's jobbing, just but, very difficult, yeah.
But mostly at Secretary of State level, you will go...
Yeah, I mean, Lucy Powell, for example, I thought was really quite impressive at education and did a good job when she was opposing that. I think it's harder for Angela Rayner, who's now in that brief and also at Women and Equalities, because she's just, you know, she's only just started doing it and she's doing two different briefs.
Although, actually, in terms of one of my hobby horses, which obviously the listeners are not bored of at all, is DFID, right? So DFID is currently being staffed by...
People who hate DFID and the concept of DFID.
People who hate development, hate the development target. What is Kate Ozimel doing? On the day that it was reported in the Telegraph that they're effectively going to rebrand it as Money with Menaces for international trade purposes, she wrote a very good piece for us about the state of the Labour Party. It was like, are you not this quite important issue? No.
In fairness, we did ask her to write that piece about the state of the Labour Party, but I take you. Never let it be said that we are ungrateful for people who contribute pieces to us about the state of the Labour Party. But I do take your point. And I guess this is...
But I think it comes back to the ancient problem that most people do not care all that much about development at a policy. They're happy the 0.7% target is there, but in terms of the nitty-gritty of the policy, they're not that into it.
But that also comes towards the point that I've been reaching towards, which I haven't yet found a non-offensive way of expressing, so I'm just going to say it anyway, which is that... More of the people who are more closely involved in politics are more likely to have a negative opinion of Corbyn and his team. I think there is a decent correlation between people who are really invested in the minutiae and the day-to-day, because they will have seen and noticed something like that.
Yeah, and I think that is part of what has gone wrong with the relationships between both sides, as it were, is that... I mean, it's really striking to me that in every YouGov poll of the membership, whenever you ask people if they've heard of Angela Eagle or Owen Smith, effectively, Liz Kendall supporters will know who all of the people are. They will be following the news much more closely. Then Yvette supporters, then Andy Burnham supporters, then Jeremy Corbyn supporters. And obviously all of these people follow the news much more than, you know...
Normal people.
people who don't join political parties.
Yeah.
But... Yeah, and there is clearly, and you can see it in his approval ratings, which are weirdly almost a mirror image of his approval ratings in the country at large. So
Jeremy Corbyn
is most popular in London among ordinary voters, but he's still very popular among the London Labour Party. It's worth pointing out, and this narrative about his London problem is slightly overcooked, but he is least popular. He is merely very popular among London members, as opposed to overwhelmingly popular. And
but
it
I
is striking,
that, I, yeah. I
and then councillors, it is striking. Then basically, the closer you are to him, the less interesting. Although, of course,
but we've got so used to using elite as a pejorative, haven't we? Whereas sometimes it just stands in for person whose day to day job is in politics, or whose job involves a day to day knowledge of politics. That it's almost become kind of unfashionable to say that anybody might know more about politics than anybody else. That's kind of...
Oh, well, good luck with that in your inbox.
it's all right. The podcast listeners, as I've discovered, are really sane. And when they disagree with you, they send you very long, thoughtful emails in which, you know, you have a really interesting, like, you learn something from it.
Sorry,
it's not Twitter, Stephen.
But anyway, on the subject of people escaping from Westminster, the Conservatives have a much deeper bench in most places. But actually, in the West Midlands, they don't. Really, they've continually failed to win seats in Birmingham, which they really ought to have. Edgbaston, obviously, being the classic example, although it's by no means the only. Yardley is another interesting place where they've effectively still been one of those places.
They took off the Lib Dems, right, in 2015.
Yeah, Labour took off the Lib Dems, but it's an interesting example of a place where, you know, a long time ago it was a three-way. The Lib Dems gradually ate the Conservative Party. Now the Lib Dems have collapsed, but the Conservatives haven't recovered to a point.
And the way that the Lib Dem MP in Yardley fell is amazing, by the way. I don't know. I mean, you probably know this story better than I did. It was like, it involved someone alleging that someone else's mistress had poisoned their cat. I mean, it was, you just, you know, I read that and I was like, oh, you don't get political scandals like that very often.
But they don't have that great a bench there. Although someone who is interesting to watch out for is Andy Cook, who is a very good long-term friend of Michael Fabricant, who's obviously an MP in Lichfield. And he is the... is it a CEO if you're a co-op? He's the panjandrum of John Lewis, which is obviously a large and well-loved force throughout the country, but particularly in the bits of that electoral region that they'd need to win it. So it feels unlikely that the Tories will win there, even if they can get Andy Cook to do it. But you wouldn't bet against... Yeah, Sean,
it's
Sean
not so
Simon
not
is
like
the,
it is in the, Liverpool or Manchester.
It's the only...
Okay, can I talk about a couple of other things that I thought were really interesting that came out of it? The number of people, and I think you noticed this before I did, the small number of people who voted in the Labour Manchester primary. So I think it's a metro region of, 3 million people, and actually you ended up with about 8,000 people, something like that.
7,000 people.
Voting in the primary. I mean, they went, you know, and Andy Burnham there got just over half of those, I believe.
Yeah, and they did have a freeze date that was a very long way back. Slightly confusingly, I have one message from the Labour Party saying the freeze date was 6 months, another saying it was 12 months. They've both been set at the same time. I'm getting conflicting reports from campaigns, but my impression is it was a 12-month freeze date.
I had heard that it was the last general election, essentially, and anyone after that was...
July 2015. Yeah. So it's kind of only like the kind of first wave of the Corbyn surge, as it were. But it is striking that my own local borough of Hackney, where again... a similar foregone conclusion, a similar...
For May, you mean?
Jules Piper has been recruited. So Sadiq Khan, perhaps to make up for his ancestral crime of being a South Londoner, has been pillaging my local borough for talent to staff City Hall, to the point that one of our councillors joked on Twitter that every time they see Sadiq Khan with a Hackney Labour member, they worry it will be the last time they see them.
Well, he's got James Murray on housing, hasn't he?
From Islington.
And Tom Copley is City Hall spokesman.
In the GLA, so he's, but he's got, from Hackney, he's taken Sophie Linden to be his policing person, and she's been very impressed. She's taken Jules Pipe, our mayor, to work for him as well. So we have a mayoral by-election, which will be fought by Philip Glanville, who is currently councillor for housing, who I'm very fond of because, full disclosure, he once rescued me from a lift in our flat when it broke down.
Personally, he didn't send someone.
I was in this lift, you know, stuck. And I decided to send a subtweet about local authority accountability because, you know, this obsession people have with, like, this idea, no, if you reform public service and the local authority, and it's like, I mean, one, they were created in 1906 to solve a religious squabble, right? They're not a perfect solution to many things. But also, if I'm in this lift, right, and I like that Hackney Council has a great recycling policy, but the lift breaks down, what's my democratic sanction? I don't want to get rid of my councillors. I like my councillors. Also, it's in Hackney, even if I hated my councillors. My latest one got 3,000 votes in a by-election. 3,000 votes. That's more votes than there were votes. So there were more votes cast for the Labour Party in Stoke Newington than there were votes cast to select the mayoral candidate to replace Jules Pipe.
Okay, if you're allowed to complain about being stuck in a lift, am I allowed to complain that I moved to Lewisham in April and it took until last week for them to get me a normal wheelie bin and they still haven't got me a recycling bin?
So you wouldn't have that in Hackney. Hackney is very good on green issues. And actually, to be fair, I only sent one tweet on the lift and he...
But did you tweet that you were trapped in a lift?
Yeah, I was like, thoughts don't occur to you when you're stuck in a lift. Because I did phone the lift service people first to be like, get me out of this lift. And then I was waiting in the lift and he asked me to let him know, email him with what the secure, with what the, you know, issue number was.
I think we should talk more about at some point about how lifts are a menace. I had a group of friends who got stuck in a lift over bank holiday, and it took them ages basically to say that they would be able to call anyone out. Eventually, because it was stuck between floors, they just crawled out. And the lift engineer went, you know, did that sort of like plumber thing, like sucking air between his teeth. Where he said, well, that's what normally what people do. They try and actually just, you know, climb out. But the problem is that they can end up getting cut in half. Anyway, that has nothing to do with Labour's mayoral elections.
Mayoral elections.
But can we just talk about the two things I think are really interesting? So we've done one, which is the smallness of Manchester's party.
Because the thing is, even though those are both pre-surge, it turns out there are more members, and I'm told from having talked to people from both Greater Manchester and the Hackney Labour Party, and this is still true, there are more members in the London Borough of Hackney, which has 250,000 people, than there are in the Greater Manchester region, which has 2.5 million.
Yeah, I was talking to someone who's going to the CLP, Islington North CLP meeting about who they're going to nominate. Spoiler alert. Pretty sure it's going to be Jeremy Corbyn. And they're expecting kind of basically 1,000 people to turn up, certainly in the hundreds of people.
Are they not going to do it via a GC?
As I understand it, it's a meeting tonight. But,
That seems... Because mostly... So I've got way too involved in this. So there are two ways you can nominate. Most general committees and all members meeting. I find it remarkable in the Labour Party, a party which loves anti-democratic fixing, people have managed to fixate on something which is in fact not a fix. I mean, like, seeing as if you picked at random things to fixate on the Labour Party, your chances of hitting a fix are higher than they are not. I find it amazing that people have managed to pick this one. Jeremy is winning in all member meetings. He's winning in GCs. If you stripped one out and stripped the other one in, he would be winning.
I think
by
it's really interesting
margins.
The number of people now that I've been following. You've been doing updates, sadly, slightly for your band names and bits of the shipping forecast and last year about CLP nominations. It's interesting the number of places that didn't nominate last time that have nominated Corbyn this time. I think that is an interesting shift. No, the other thing I was going to say was the other thing is the sort of the lack of discrimination against people from the national stage in these mayoral sections. I'm actually thinking of Liverpool and Manchester, which is that. In the end, you know, they didn't go for an existing mayor, somebody who's based in a regional politician. They have gone for Andy Burnham, who is a cabinet member, and Steve Rotherham, who is Corbyn's PPS. I mean, I know he had previously had roles in local politics, so Steve Rotherham's slightly different case. But there's not a kind of... This anti-Westminster sentiment has not extended to the extent of saying, well, we wouldn't want to pick anyone who's an MP because they're...
I mean, I think the thing with both Steve and with Andy Burnham is that they are genuinely politicians who... And I'd like to make it clear, I don't actually have that much of a problem with, kind of... An MP's job is to do casework and represent someone in the House of Commons. Actually, if they want to live with their kids full-time in the week in London, which is where they spend most of their time... I'm personally fine with it, and actually, all the evidence is voters are mostly fine with it. I mean, like,
but they do need to keep a connection and do constituency. I mean, they did some investigation a while ago, and there were some MPs who sort of literally hadn't done a constituency surgery in 14 years. Right, if you neglect your constituency like that, it's different.
But my instinct is that Andy Burnham would not have beaten. I don't understand why I can't ever remember his name.
Go on,
Tony Lloyd. I keep wanting to call him Richard Lloyd because Richard Lee is just this weird portmanteau that I've started to do.
Not David Lloyd after the gym.
It's very strange. I think people who have first surnames, which are first names, always like they kind of trigger my the sleeping giant of my dyslexia kind of comes away. It's like, whoa, what's this? Someone with two names. What is it? I don't know why that's the
that's a voice good impression of your sleeping giant, but
So I don't think he would have beaten him if he had not been an MP who does spend his weekends in his constituency, who does live there, whose kids go to school, etc., etc. I think he is more... obviously there are political reasons why I think Caroline Flint may struggle if she goes for the combined authorities mayor there, but I think she will find it easier because she does actually
spend
a lot of time in Don Valley than, say, Ed Miliband, who obviously people in Doncaster North have not had a problem re-electing. But
don't feel that he's engaged
but, you know,
in the
he is not,
to that
yeah,
level.
He is not an MP who lives in
but
his
also
constituency,
let's take,
nor has he ever pretended to be.
No. But also, let's take a moment to say that Andy Burnham made the strategically correct call to stay in the shadow cabinet.
Yeah, I mean, so I know I'm getting brickbats for this in this office, but I've become an Andy Burnham revisionist.
Well, you've more become like a, I was going to say like an Andy Burnham truther, but it's more, you've become an Andy Burnham kind of fanboy, I think, in the sense that you're quite willing to forgive him for making decisions based on, well, okay, I don't think it's actually, do you know what, it's fair enough, because actually I don't have a problem with politicians making strategic decisions and not being. I think one of the reasons my problems with Jeremy Corbyn is that the feeling that he always makes the principal decision no matter what the consequences, and actually I believe in real politics, and I believe that, for example, you have to engage with unpleasant regimes or you have to meet unpleasant people in order to forge political solutions. So actually, I will come with you on this and say that although I thought it was a bit cowardly of Andy Burnham, who obviously is no great Corbyn fan, not to join everyone else, actually, if it ends up with Labour having a strong, I guess it just depends on what you think, Andy Burnham is a sufficiently strong candidate for mayor that they needed him to do that. Does the end justify the means?
I know. So I think there are a couple of points and I think are worth... And yeah, one full disclosure, a long time ago in another life, as it were, I did in fact help on Andy Burnham's first campaign to be leader of the Labour Party.
I'm going to tip off the canary about that. They can write one of those long articles about everyone you met.
So the destruction of his reputation in the leadership race resulted in the fact that he went fairly far to the right and then pelted back to the left. But that was based on two, in my view, 100% correct opinions. The first was that you couldn't win the 2020 election on the platform and the financial decisions taken towards the end of the last Labour government were fine and dandy.
Mm-hmm.
That was an insight that he got, Liz Kendall got, Yvette Cooper did not get. Yvette Cooper wanted to go into the 2020 election going, no, the 067 spending round was fine.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand why we think that Yvette Cooper would have been more successful than Gordon Brown or Ed Miliband in that approach.
Okay, so yeah.
And the second thing he realised was that you could not win a Labour leadership election.
Saying that
and running to the right. He came to those conclusions in the wrong order, but so did every commentator pretty much. About the Labour leadership race. The only difference is he was the only politician who actually had to be in the position of having to do those things, right?
Yeah.
Every commentator on the centre-left, through to the centre, to the right, basically went, yeah, like, the you can't defend the record, et cetera, et cetera. You've got to accept, it didn't work, falling over at that question time, et cetera, et cetera. And then there was kind of a holdout of, Brownites, Blairites who don't want to admit that, you have to kind of accept and you can't defend every line of the record, et cetera, et cetera. And people, weirdly, on the far left, this weird alliance of diehard New Labourites and the traditional far left of the Labour Party.
So what you're saying is it'll be really sad, but next year you'll probably leave the podcast because you're going to go and become Andy Burnham's spokesman.
Yeah, I mean, I reckon he'll probably get someone from the north, but...
You can affect a northern accent. What's the worst that could happen?
What is indeed the worst that could happen? But I think the other important thing we need to talk about these elections is...
Sausage Fest?
Yeah. Obviously, as it turns out, I am a secret Andy Burnham fanboy. Steve Rotherham, I have a lot of time for. Really liked in the PLP. Lovely bloke, etc., etc.
Sean Simon has stepped back from frontline politics for a while, I think, actually, and therefore
he's been an MEP.
Yeah,
which
is like the
people just keep baiting my pro-European.
But you could be sort of running MI5 or on the side and be an MEP, and no one would kind of clock it, right?
I would clock.
Okay, yeah, you would clock.
Sean Simon, who's kind of like, in that kind of like...
But all I mean is he's got a lot less scrutiny, and that race has got a lot less scrutiny and it proves about the personality politics of the mayoral race, because actually the same thing you could say about Marvin Rees in Bristol, right? It just hasn't got, at the national level, the same amount of attention because he's not, there's no Westminster kind of, byplay involved in that.
In terms of the people not wanting people from their local areas element, I mean, one, Joe Anderson made... a couple of mistakes, but there's an interesting trend, which is increasingly the thing that the Conservatives will do if they do want to continue with any form of spending cuts. Depending on what the economy does, they may end up not doing that and just having a lot of stimulus. But they will continue to devolve it on Labour areas. The interesting thing is, in the first half of the 2010-15 Parliament, being a council leader was an insurmountable advantage if you wanted to be selected. And then basically by about 2013, council leaders started to lose because they'd started to have to make a lot of cuts. They'd upset a lot of people. And it suddenly became very hard for council leaders to become MPs.
Although I'm thinking of Jim McMahon in Oldham.
Yeah.
He's the kind of I guess yeah, there will always be an exception.
There will always be an exception.
That is interesting. But I also
And I think Joe did have a lot of enemies. He also made a mistake that a lot of Londoners made, and also actually a lot of Lloyd's staff made when Andy went into the race, which is they were like, oh, isn't he a Scouser? I don't know why I said Scouser with a hard A. Scouser. I don't, anyway.
Yeah, I did hear that a lot. People just sort of said that. Like, there was this kind of, it's like Sunni Shia sectarian rivalry, and I kind of thought, well, actually,
and I think this
I could see like being a Londoner being a real problem, but I you know, I mean, I know there are football derbies and things that I know not what of because that's not my area that divide the big cities in the north. But yeah, I never really kind of quite got that.
I also think that the thing that a lot of people didn't pick up on, and to be honest, this is something I did write up in the initial write up when he got into the race. There were lots of people in Greater Manchester, you know, in the greater bit, who did not want it to be a Manchester mayor. And the fact that he is an MP for Greater Manchester, but you cannot accuse him of being someone who is going to be, you know, no, I'm not saying he's going to be an enemy of the city of Manchester, but he's not going to be...
Is it that you'd rather have a Liverpool or Everton supporter than if you're a Man City fan, you'd than have a Man U fan or vice versa? Right?
Well, it's actually sort of vice versa because Man U is actually not the team of the physical city unit, is it? But it's a bit like, in some ways, it's kind of like people in Zone 6 sort of want to know that the London mayor will have their own interest, will have their interests at heart as well. And I think one of the things people underestimated was that Andy Burnham could speak to that.
He was a unity candidate.
Yeah. And also, I think the mistake Joe Anderson made is a lot of people in the Liverpool area were upset by him being like, oh, isn't he a plastic Scouser? So he kind of did hit himself on both sides. And so I think he did struggle for that reason. You know, it was not a flawless campaign.
Okay, let's talk about the blokiness of it, though. So you've ended up with, I think what's, you know,
men.
What is a small ray of sunshine is that you have ended up with two BME men in that, Martin Rees and also Sadiq Khan. However, it does seem that in every case you could make an argument for why the person who won, right? Yeah. And so this is always the difficulty when you're talking about sort of discrimination in these kind of races. It's just that somehow the criteria for what people want in any situation always seem to include women. That's the thing. I don't think you can look at any of those people and say, it was, you know, what a terrible decision they've made. You know, they made a horrible choice. They've obviously overlooked a much better woman. But it does seem to be that there is something going on where whatever it is that people want will always turn out to be not something that someone with 2X chromosomes has.
I mean, I think, to me, Sadiq is, I think, the one who you can actually most obviously query. I mean, Sadiq was a great candidate. The London field was astonishingly strong. I mean, the point one Conservative made to me is they said, yeah, really early on, they said, well, the unnerving thing is they could pick their fourth best candidate and their candidate would still be significantly better than our first best candidate. This person actually thought that Sadiq was their third best candidate. They thought David Lammy and Tessa Jowell were stronger options. But I think it is a measure of how good Labour's London bench is and was than it was, you know. But the thing is, if you wanted to vote for the most left-wing candidate,
are we going to do your? Are you going to do your calling out? If you voted
until,
for Corbyn and you didn't vote for Diane Abbott, you are a racist
until
and a sexist.
Until I die, I'm going to keep ranting about this. Right? She got 16% of the vote. Right? 16% of the vote in the same election. Jeremy Corbyn got 60% of the vote. We don't have a London breakdown, but in terms of the size of the London membership, it is not plausible that he didn't get at least 50% of the vote in London. So we know that there was a massive gap between the two most left-wing candidates and two very obvious differences. And okay, you know, so there will be people who will start honking on about private school or, oh, you know, I'm sorry.
The thing about the private school is fascinating though, because that's one very high profile mistake or misstep. But, you know, Tony Blair sent his kids across London to the Oratory, which I know is technically a state school, but was a selective on grounds of religion. But also, if Diane Abbott's child is now, like, what, 50? I mean, if that's the thing that you hate Diane Abbott for, you know, you update your CV, really.
I also think it's just one of those things where people are willing to forgive Jeremy Corbyn for going on air. In fact, not only are they willing to forgive him for this, they are willing to make excuses which literally demean themselves. People are willing to humiliate themselves. I'm sorry, if you're one of the people who goes, he didn't really mean now when he said R50 now, you are basically like a child who has wet themselves in public, but you don't understand that's what you've done.
Oh, I people thought you were going to get angry about Press TV, because I was going to get angry about Press TV. So the state broadcaster of a theocratic regime kills gay people, stones adulteresses, and he hosted a phone-in show in which he watched somebody say that Israel is a disease, and he went, well, that's a very interesting opinion, and now on to the next caller.
Yeah.
And to say, well, whatever. And then to be upset that Diane Abbott, who, when there is an established problem with black teenage boys in London facing educational disadvantage, made a selfish choice, but one that was, she thought, in his best interests.
Yeah, it's not like she voted for school vouchers or grammar schools or, it's crazy talk. It is just one of those things where I just feel like I am willing to accept that you can forgive Jeremy Corbyn for those things. I am willing, However, if you're not willing to forgive Diane Abbott that, I'm afraid, sorry.
Well, you hold her to a higher standard, don't you? That's the thing. You're looking for something.
I do think that there is a racial and a gender aspect to that. I'm afraid I do think if you voted for Jeremy Corbyn, but you did not vote for Diane Abbott in the mayoral race, you probably are a bit of a sexist and racist. You know, I'm not saying you're one of the people who shouts at me in the street, but you probably are one of the people who, if I invite you, invited me for a job interview, does a slight double take. Yeah, like, this is the thing, it's like, prejudice is not something that you escape merely by thinking yourself left-wing.
The one argument I will buy, actually, about why people who... Because to you and me, right, Diane Abbott is somebody who is an accomplished media performer, right? She will go on TV, she sat on the sofa, which, you know, on This Week next to Portillo, talked about trains, made joke, you know, and she served in the shadow cabinet under Ed Miliband. And she made a principled resignation from the shadow cabinet over the first Syria vote, which I and you see as well. She's come to it with lots of experience. But the counterpoint is that quite a lot of people, I think, who voted for Jeremy Corbyn, actually, they wanted someone completely untainted by the whiff of any kind of engagement with the system. And I think that is the one... If that's your value system, I think that's the one thing I do accept. Because to me, that's a... You know, the fact that Jeremy Corbyn hadn't chaired a select committee, hadn't ever served in the shadow cabinet, none of that stuff is a disadvantage. But I think to some of his supporters, his total purity and sort of never having sullied himself with that is an advantage.
I'm willing to account for...
But that's maybe like 10%.
Some of those people. But I'm just saying there's 40% of the Labour Party does have a case to answer there. And also, Sadiq, obviously, you know, a very talented campaigner. But if you've got to the point where you've decided that you don't care, and policy-wise, who was the person who had the most plausible solutions in terms of the actual powers of the mayor and housing? It was David Lammy, who wanted to build on the Greenbelt. Mm. And then if you take the view that, you can't build on the Greenbelt because of electability, then actually Tessa Jowell had a better housing policy, as shown by the fact that he nicked it the day after he was elected. And she was more popular in the polls, and I think probably would have done even better. Obviously I spent more time than was healthy looking at the ward-by-ward results. And by the way, if you work for any of the boroughs in the Greater Manchester or Liverpool metro areas, I am going to FOI it anyway. So if you could just publish it of your own volition the day after, then it would just make everyone's lives a bit easier.
Well, talking of which, you wrote a piece which argued that Sadiq Khan had a kind of Corbyn bump. He definitely benefited from Corbyn's time as Labour leader, which I think is a plausible thing when you look at the surge in membership across all the London Labour parties. Will Andy Burnham get a Corbyn bump in the sense of Manchester voters?
Yes and no, right? And this is why I am hoping that they will, because lots of councils do produce these results ward by ward, which they should, because it's really useful for academics and nerds like me. But it's also useful for, you know, democratic accountability. But yeah, he will do very well in Manchester Withington because of Jeremy Corbyn. There will be people who have come into the Labour tent who will
And presumably the Manchester Labour Party, although were small before last year has increased in size over the last year. And that just puts more boots on the ground in terms of door knocking and membership phone banking.
Most people, 10% of the membership door knocks, and that basically doesn't change regardless of their politics, really. It will help him in some places. The thing I hear anecdotally from a lot of MPs, including MPs who do not have any time for Jeremy, is they will say in their patches, their places with a lot of students and a large Pakistani vote, the foreign policy stuff has helped them. One MP said to me, I have this weird thing where I go canvassing in student areas and they're very angry at the idea than people are saying Jeremy is anti-Semitic. They don't think it can possibly be true. Then I go down the other end of my patch and I'm knocking on doors where people are happy at the idea that he is anti-Semitic. The thing is, it's actually true in some majority black areas as well, because of the evangelical church and Judaism. So it will be interesting to see in the areas which are majority Muslim.
The polarization. People who are already kind of in that direction anyway have gone further and pushed further to love, and then people who were slightly against have been driven. There's not very many people who feel ambivalent about Jeremy Corbyn.
Well, because the interesting thing is, it's basically a more emphatic version of Miliband's policy platforms, and it is securing slightly more emphatic versions of what Ed got in some places. So my guess is it will be a bit of a wash, really, in Manchester. It won't be, because although some people got very cross with that article, in terms of the places where Jeremy Corbyn is a massive asset to you, London, Bristol, Norwich, Crawley, Brighton. Oxford, a little bit less
Cambridge.
So, Cambridge. Well, because the thing is with Cambridge is, it's another one of those weird three-way marginals where the Lib Dems have eaten the Conservatives, and it'll be very interesting to see how
it's
that plays out.
It's a very small city centre as well, isn't it?
But yeah, that's the thing. It's also that classic thing where you've got a city, you've then got kind of places like Cherry Hinton, which feel and look like the stereotype people have in their minds of a safe Labour seat. And then you have like, Shires. Oh, this is a bit weird. And I realise I don't know what if Cambridge is too small, because if it is too small and it's due to get bigger in boundary changes, then that makes that seat quite interesting.
Can we quickly, before we finish this, just talk about somewhere else that I don't think that Corbynism is really expanding the Labour vote, and I think has just been weirdly just kind of like written off, particularly by Corbyn's, Scotland. I had a lot of people telling me last summer that what was needed in Scotland was a proper anti-austerity party, and actually that Corbyn was going to be very popular there. But he hasn't visited Scottish cities very much. He has done a little bit, and I would suggest that he doesn't seem to be an electoral. It's yet another part of the way in which Scotland is drifting away into its own. I mean, it already is, to a large extent, has its own political culture.
Yeah.
But this is another nail in that coffin. You haven't ended up with a Labour leader who has personal popularity in large parts of Scotland.
Yeah, so the interesting thing, he is slightly more popular with SNP voters than he is with Labour voters in Scotland. So Scottish Labour voters dislike him slightly more. That is an interesting trend. Yeah, I think I always thought there was a bit of a misnomer to see it as about the Labour Party's left-right position. The strongest reason to vote for the SNP is that you want Scotland to be an independent country.
But also that you want to have people whose entire guiding principle in politics is to get the best deal for Scotland. They don't have to make any concessions to balance any other bits of their party, right? I think that's a really important thing, is that you don't think of there being kind of horse trading about, a Labour Party would have to kind of appease voters in other parts of the country, so it can't argue for the best deal.
That has started to break down a bit. So because their great success in 2007 a bit, but obviously most significantly in 2011, was in effectively saying, well, the Scottish, the referendum issue, the independence issue, that's for a referendum. And then they did that. Then they had a very effective referendum campaign, partly because although there were the Scottish Greens and various small parties, they were effectively the Party of Independence. And it was a 3-year advert for their policy platform. But if you look under the surface, there's actually quite a lot of churn in their vote, which is one of the reasons why what happened with the Tories this time happened. In the people who were unionists, who might have voted Conservative in Westminster, but who were quite comfortable with the SNP's policy platform and thought they'd get a good deal and ran Holyrood well, went back to the Conservatives because of the union this time. So there's a slight unravelling of that. Although my instinct is actually that is probably, if I were an SNP strategist, I would feel a situation in which my main opposition was the political right saying let's stay in the union would suit me down to the ground. But
yeah, that, I mean, there does feel like there has been, and for all that people chuff on about realignments in politics, it does feel as if Scotland has had essentially a realignment.
But I think, because the thing is that there wasn't really, from a wonkish perspective, a whole lot of difference between the SNP manifesto and Ed Miliband's manifesto. You can argue about which one is more left-wing or more right-wing, depending on how you feel about various policy levers. But to be honest, it's a fun pub chat, but it's not really, you know, it's kind of arguable. It didn't feel likely there was a great wave of votes to be unlocked by going to the SNP's left. It's turned out there wasn't. They did also run on a platform to the left of the SNP in the Holyrood elections, you know, tax, etc.
A penny on income tax and restoring the 50p rate. See, I think the 50p rate is a really fascinating symptom of the SNP's ability to triangulate without it looking like triangulation. I mean, it just shows you what a nimble political leader Nicola Sturgeon is.
I mean, so I'm going to defend them on the 50p rate because I'm horrendously right-wing.
Do you think, I mean, there is an argument to be made that the 50p rate, like, if you, like, in the same way that tuition fees, you just actually, if you look at the economics of it, it is defensible as a policy. But I think as a signal, it's different. I don't think you can.
I mean, I think I'm not convinced. So obviously, at some point, when you raise taxes on the very rich, you lose more in foregone income. I'm not convinced that 50p is that level. I think probably it's probably actually when you get to sort of 55, 56, 58, then actually that's when you start to have problems. Philosophically, I don't like the idea of people paying more than half, but I also don't like VAT being at 20%. So, you know, you've kind of...
It's not about what you want.
It's important for your tax policy to be progressive and then kind of hopefully it's progressive in a way which is not philosophically uncomfortable, but it's more important for them to be fair. However, if you have an open land border, a shared language, shared roads, I am aware of no serious figure in the Scottish independence movement who is proposing that even under independence, you would not have a situation.
You'd
in
rebuild
which,
Hadrian's Wall, but, start I mean, speaking Gaelic, and
but
then...
It is much more
like the Scottish pound.
To suggest that, I mean, I find the idea that I would be paying a 50p rate slightly far-fetched. Anyway, but the idea that I would move to Geneva, if I live in London, to avoid the 50p rate...
It's
pretty dull in Geneva. It's quite far away from everyone I know and like. However, the idea
Lovely
that
lake.
You might move to the borders if you work in Edinburgh or anywhere in that bit of Scotland, yeah, like if you're well paid and you work in broadcasting or public services, you know, the idea you're not going to add half an hour onto your commute in order to
save
a massive amount of money.
Look, we must.
That is obviously very different. So the 50p rate argument for the SNP, regardless of... And it was a classic example of a missed goal by Scottish Labour. Rather than having this opportunistic thing where they've started to oppose policies, then you know, they're good left-wing policies, named persons policies. It's a great policy. You can tell because it unites awful, like, posh social liberals who are like, oh, you know, does the state know better how to raise kids? Yes. With right-wingers who are like, oh, does it matter, does the state how to raise kids? Again, yes. The SNP...
Yeah, okay. Well, we must draw things to a close because otherwise we will never, ever stop. But we'll no doubt revisit this as the mayoral contests, most of them aren't happening until 2017, so there'll be plenty of time.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, presented by me, Helen Lewis, and produced by Anna Leskovitz. You can find us every week at newstatesman.com/podcast or on iTunes. Our theme music is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.